This is Digital Story Podcast number 655, October 2nd, 2018. Today's theme is my top 5 Photokina picks. I'm Derek Story. Photokina is the largest photography show that I've ever personally attended. And once again, it didn't disappoint in terms of major announcements. There was gear that dazzled me, while other news, well, just puzzled me. However, this week I'm going to talk about those products that turned my head. Please join me. So I thought this year's show was interesting. It just concluded last week. And in part, I think a lot of the reasons why this show was interesting was because of the mirrorless movement. Nikon and Canon sort of got the ball rolling well before the show started. But then we had some other announcements that were related to mirrorless photography, in addition to quite a few lenses for both DSLRs and mirrorless, and then some other goodies as well. And all in all, it was a pretty satisfying event. Lots of good things for us to think about. Now, of course, we never know how much of this stuff is really going to show up and how it's going to look when it does and when it's going to show up. And of course, how much it's going to cost. But for now, we'll just put a bookmark on those questions and just focus on the announcements themselves. I have 5 things that really caught my eye, and I know you're surprised by that number, but it's true. 5 things that I'm interested in, I'm personally interested in, and I would like to see them come to fruition. So let's get to that list and talk about those things. So at the top, of course, is the Panasonic Lumix S1R. I mean, this was kind of a latecomer to the party, right? I mean, we already knew about Nikon mirrorless. We already knew about Canon mirrorless. We had heard some rumblings in some other corners. And then we started to hear some noise, some peeps, some little sounds that Panasonic might be coming out with camera themselves. And sure enough, they did. And what's really neat about it is that it came with a partnership, a Panasonic Leica Sigma L-mount partnership that provides a really interesting full-frame alternative to Sony, Canon, and Nikon. So Panasonic, who already knows how to do partnerships, has done a very good Micro Four Thirds partnership with Olympus, is now also going to be working with Leica and Sigma. Now, as I studied this camera, the new Lumix S1R, the first thing that really jumped out at me was that it's big. I mean, it's big. It's a big camera. And then, of course, it has big lenses because it's full frame. So, I mean, what we're looking at here isn't the nimble version of mirrorless. And I think mirrorless is starting to divide itself into a couple different camps here. So there's the nimble mirrorless, which can be APS-C sensor, depending on the camera. For instance, Fujifilms, a lot of them are very compact. Or it can be Micro Four Thirds, which is Olympus and Panasonic. Those can be extremely compact. And then, of course, Sony has tried its hand and I think done a pretty good job at creating very compact cameras with reasonable sensors in them. So, you know, there's that camp, the nimble camp. And then there's the camp that just says, look, mirrorless is just a different way to, you know, create a viewing system. It's one that we like. We like the electronic viewfinder because you get real-time feedback when looking through the viewfinder, as opposed to an optical viewfinder where you do see the world through glass, but you don't get things like real-time exposure adjustment and things like that. So that camp seemed to dominate, you know, this year in Photokina, mainly because there is now this emphasis on full-frame cameras, on cameras that have a nice big sensor, and a sensor same size as a 35mm piece of film. And Panasonic is definitely there, and this thing is a handful, this S1R, and so are its lenses. However, I think it's going to be a very capable camera, and I think it's interesting that you can put Leica lenses on there, We know Panasonic will hold up their end of the bargain and create some very interesting lenses as well. And then we have Sigma in there, who has been very productive, very proficient at creating glass for these different mounts, and they're going to be creating some interesting stuff. So I think this is going to be a lot of fun, and I think it's probably going to be a very good video camera. I think it's going to have some, you know, very innovative features, things that Panasonic has learned along the way through their Micro Four Thirds cameras. If you want a big camera, if you're okay with that, if you're okay with the handful mirrorless, maybe that's what I'll call it. I'll call it the handful mirrorless, as opposed to the nimble mirrorless. This S1R should be an interesting option to Sony, to Canon, and to Nikon. I definitely was intrigued enough to add it to my top five list, and I can't wait to learn more about it and to actually shoot with it. The Fujifilm GFX50R. Now, on the other hand, this is a relatively compact, medium format rangefinder, and also relatively affordable for a medium format digital camera. Coming in at $4,500, that's the estimated price right now. So it seems like Fuji has gone a different route than Canon and Nikon and Sony, in that they bypassed the full-frame sensor and went right to medium format. So they have APS-C, and their APS-C cameras are fabulous. They're just great cameras. And then they have now a couple medium format cameras that are relatively affordable and look really nice. And if they have that Fujifilm magic, which I'm sure they do, I mean, the first medium format camera seems to have done well, and I anticipate that the GFX50R will as well, then we have this really cool, relatively nimble, medium format camera, you know, being rangefinder style and all, that you can take just about anywhere and have this huge sensor to play with. So I'm pretty excited about this. Now, it'd be interesting to see that over time, Fuji's decision to skip full frame and to go right into medium format, if that tends to be a wise one or not. I'll tell you what my gut says is that, you know, rushing to a crowded space is probably not the best way to distinguish yourself. So I think going to a space that you can dominate, medium format in this case, at least on paper, seems like a wise decision to me. So I'm pretty excited about what they're doing in general. I'm very excited about their medium format cameras. And I have my fingers crossed that this one, the GFX50R, is going to be a camera that really appeals to a lot of people. My third pick, the Ricoh GR3, and I had a feeling that this one was going to make the list when I first saw this camera, partly because I have a soft spot for the GR2. I tested it way back when I was writing for Macworld magazine. Man, I mean, that's been a while. Talk about, you know, a period of time in between updates. That has been a while. At any rate, what Ricoh is doing is updating a compact classic, has an APS-C sensor in a very small camera, has a fixed lens, and what they're doing with the new camera is that they're updating the sensor. So they're going to go from 16 megapixels to 24 megapixels. They're adding a touch screen, and they're adding image stabilization. Now, image stabilization is interesting on this camera to me because the Fujifilm XF10, which also has a 28mm f2.8 lens, decided not to put image stabilization in, and Ricoh is going to do it. And I think on a wide lens, it can go either way. My experience with the XF10 has been that I don't really think it needs image stabilization. Yes, I would love it if it had it, but I don't seem to be missing it. So, you know, who knows? I think that's a personal thing. I think we'll have to put that in a personal category. So everything on paper looks really good with the Ricoh GR3. The thing is, we don't really know when we'll see it. It's going to be sometime next year. Ricoh's indicating that it'll be in the first part of next year and not later, but we never know. And really what they announced was its development. So in other words, they're saying, yeah, we're working on it. We're going to work on it. But we don't really have anything beyond just this prototype that you can look at. There's also no price yet. A lot of folks think it's going to be up around $1,000 when it comes out. If it is indeed up around $1,000, then that would end up being twice as much as the XF10, which comes in at $499. So there's a lot of things here that we're just going to have to wait and see. We'll know when we know. However, I am glad that Ricoh is updating this camera. I think, in all honesty, that this is a camera that could do better than any of their DSLRs if they do it right in terms of sales. And I want to keep this tradition going. I think a lot of other people want to keep this tradition going. I'm crossing my fingers that they'll knock it out of the park when we see it sometime in 2019. Number four on the list. And now we've got two things that are really kind of cool, really kind of got me thinking. The first one is the Sigma 56mm f1.4 DC-DN lens for Sony E and Micro Four Thirds. So I think it's really cool that Sigma created this lens and that they created it for both Sony and Micro Four Thirds. So on the Micro Four Thirds side, the lens will behave as being equivalent to 112mm, right? Because you double, so 56, it'll be 112mm. And even though it is an f1.4, it'll behave more like a f2.8, okay? So, you know, that's if we're comparing it to full frame. So on Micro Four Thirds, you basically get 112mm f2.8 lens, which is pretty nice and great for portrait work, great for landscape, great for all sorts of stuff, street photography. There's a number of ways that you could use this lens. On the Sony E mount, it will act like an equivalent of 84mm at f2.1. So it's moves it more to the classic 85mm lens. They're making it one of their contemporary lenses, and I really like the contemporary lenses because it sort of balances, you know, premium quality with affordable price. It sort of puts it, you know, right there in the middle. The contemporary lenses that I've shot with from Sigma have felt quite good and have performed quite well. So I think that's really great news for this lens. It will have a super multi-layer coating. It is a weather-sealed construction, which is really neat, which means if you put it on a weather-sealed camera, you've got something you can go out bopping around about. And it's going to have a rounded 9-blade aperture diaphragm. So this is all really good stuff, very interesting. We don't know the price yet. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that they'll probably try to bring this in around $499, somewhere around there. We'll see. I could be off on that, but because it's a contemporary lens, I think we have a chance at that. And to have a lens of this quality for that price, that could be really fun, whether you're a Sony shooter or a Micro Four Thirds shooter. It's a handsome lens. It looks really good, and I'm crossing my fingers that it performs as well as it looks. And finally, number five on my list, and this is just one of those things where they pull out all the stops, right? We've seen Sigma do this, but this isn't a Sigma lens. This is the Leica DG Vario Summilux 10-25mm f1.7, and it's being released by Panasonic. So it is a Micro Four Thirds lens. Yes, a 10-25 constant aperture f1.7 zoom lens. So that means you get the 35mm equivalent of 20mm, 24mm, 28, 35mm, and 50mm, all of them at f1.7. Wow, how cool is that? And it's got the Leica, you know, moniker on it, so that's pretty cool too. I was looking at this lens and I was just saying, first of all, it's a handsome lens. I know it's not going to be a small lens. It can't be a small lens for what it does. It's fast and it covers just this wonderful range, right? 20 millimeters on the wide end. How cool is that? Oh, you know, instead of being limited to 24 millimeter, you got 20 millimeter. That's a big difference between 20 millimeters and 24 millimeters when you're bopping around. And then a very respectable 50 millimeters on the so-called telephoto end. That's nice. It looks good. I'm sure it's not going to be a cheap lens. And, you know, the Panasonic lenses that have the Leica branding are never cheap, but it could be a lens that you just buy and use forever. So you invest in it, you spend years of your life paying it off. But then you have even more years to enjoy it. So I'm just jazzed about this lens. I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford it or not, but I want to shoot with it. I definitely want to shoot with it. And then the other thing that I'm going to say about this lens is that when, you know, Panasonic announced its full frame entry and it announced its new alliance, you know, a lot of people started writing me and I heard people comment that, well, that they're going to leave Micro Four Thirds behind and they're just going to go full frame. And I think in the year of full frame mirrorless, which I think we're definitely in that year right now, I think it's worth spending a minute talking about this. Panasonic is not going to give up on Micro Four Thirds, okay? Because I think they realize that, yes, full frame is something that you will want to have in your portfolio, right? Because it attracts pros and it attracts high-level enthusiasts. But that being said, that you can probably sell more cameras, more affordable cameras, with Micro Four Thirds sensor in it, and in the end, you know, really do better by Micro Four Thirds financially than you would with full frame. So you sort of need full frame for the swagger, right? Yeah, we got full frame. Yeah. Pros shoot with our cameras. Yeah. You know, we got Leica lenses that go on our pro camera bodies, our pro mirrorless bodies. So, you know, you got the swagger. But at the end of the day, Micro Four Thirds is really a far more practical sensor size, especially for travel, even street photography, in all honesty, because the lenses are so much smaller and the cameras just in general don't attract as much attention. Remember earlier when I was talking about the S1R, the Panasonic S1R, this is a big camera. You take this around and people are going to look at you and think, yeah, you are a pro. You got this monster body with this big old hunk of glass on the front of it. Yeah, you know, you're serious. You know, may I see your media pass kind of thing. So Micro Four Thirds is here to stay. I think it's going to flourish. I think Panasonic is going to continue to nurture its Micro Four Thirds line of cameras. It's got a good thing going with Olympus. They have a great lens catalog in Micro Four Thirds, as does Olympus, and I just think they're going to continue to develop and do interesting things there. I think it's going to be good for their bottom line, and I think that once this wave of full frame madness passes, that a lot of people will settle back into their APS-C sensor cameras and their Micro Four Thirds cameras and, you know, take the weight off their shoulders and travel lighter and really enjoy photography on the go. So nothing to worry about in terms of, you know, these other cameras that aren't full frame right now. They're going to do just fine as long as they continue to innovate and come up with interesting lenses, continue to do interesting things in terms of how the camera operates, maybe bring a little computational photography into the mix. I don't think that would be a bad thing at all. And continue to excite us with the cameras that they develop with these smaller sensors, and smaller only relative to full frame sensors. So I think that this move by Panasonic to come out with this 10-25 f1.7 constant aperture lens was brilliant. And it's also sending a message to all of us out there going, hey, we love Micro Four Thirds. We're going to dabble in full frame And hopefully everything will work out to where we have two very robust product lines. All right, so those are my five favorites from Photokina: the Panasonic Lumix S1R mirrorless full-frame camera, the Fujifilm GFX 50R rangefinder medium format camera, the Ricoh GR3 compact camera with an APS-C sensor that's 24 megapixels, the Sigma 56mm f1.4 lens, it's a prime lens for Sony E and Micro Four Thirds, and the Leica Vario Summilux 10-25 constant aperture f1.7, oh my gosh, for Micro Four Thirds. If those don't get your pulse going, boy, I don't know what I could talk about that would. Anyway, a thoroughly enjoyable show this year. I really enjoyed following it. I like these announcements, and let's see how they all pan out in 2019. Things I learned during the TDS Fall Workshop. So those of you that follow me on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter know that I spent last week up in the mountains with some of our virtual camera club members, and I have to tell you, I had a blast. Oh my gosh. This is, you know, I have to tell you, this is when I love my work. I love the podcasting and I love the workshops. These are two things that just really thrill me. So this was the last workshop of the season. And I usually try to end the season on a bang. I think I pulled it off again this year. I had great help from Susie Powell, who attended the workshop, but who also supplied our cabin at Lake Almanor, and who also put together this killer meal plan for us. I mean, we ate like kings, thanks to Susie. She is as good at doing that, as planning and executing as a workshop co-facilitator, as she is at taking pictures. We had a great time. And one of the things that I like about workshops like this is that we're all living together. You know, we all are staying there at the cabin. We're eating together. We're going out and shooting together. We're doing lab together. It is fun. But as you can imagine, there's also a fair amount of banter that goes on while we're doing all these activities. And as the workshop goes on, and as people get more and more comfortable with each other, the banter sort of, you know, gets a little bit more, well, let's say colorful, a little bit more interesting. So at the end of the workshop, on the last day, when people were doing their final push to get their 8 images ready for presentation, I asked them, I said, okay, I'd like to know some of the things that you learned from other participants during this workshop. And I just, you know, went around while they're, you know, madly working on their computer. They probably wanted me to be quiet, right? Because they're trying to finish their images. But I was pestering them with this question. And I thought that I would share what they said with you, okay? So the folks that we had on this workshop was Dave and Kevin and Susie and Jeremy, Fred, Earl, and Kirk, okay? So, you know, you're going to get responses from all of them. So one of the things that Dave learned is, and this is when we were shooting down at Burney Falls, and we had great light in the morning, but there was one shot that he and I were working on together where we're down low, and we're basically shooting into the sun. And he had a lens hood on his camera, but then he saw me, you know, covering the front of my lens with my hand. I wasn't covering the lens itself. I was actually shading the lens with my hand. And then sometimes I'd pull off my hat. And the whole trick to this, and I know many of you do this, is that, you know, you position your hand or your hat or whatever you have so that it keeps the sun from falling directly on the front of the lens. And there's a little trick to it, because you've got a small window of operating room there. If you go too low, then you get your hat in the picture, which is no good. And if you go too high, then you don't really shade the front. Now, why would you want to shade the front of the lens? Well, because when you have light shining right on the front optic of the lens, it tends to decrease contrast, tends to desaturate color, and it can cause some lens flare. Now, sometimes lens flare is good when you intend it, and sometimes it's bad when you don't want it. So anyway, I was doing this and Dave said, wow, what are you doing? And so I explained to him what I just explained to you. And he loved that. He loved that because, you know, he was sort of feeling that if he has his lens hood on, that he's sort of doing what he needs to do. And I said, a lot of times the lens hood is plenty, but sometimes, as in the situation that we were shooting in, you need a little bit more than your lens hood, and that's where using your hand or a hat to shade the front of the lens is a great idea. Now, one thing that Kevin learned, he learned this actually from Dave, who is obsessed with McLaren cars. And one thing that Kevin learned is that you're never too old to fiercely desire a McLaren. Dave is to the point where he was suggesting that I do a McLaren car workshop. If he can't own a McLaren, at least he can spend a few days with one via one of our workshops. So we'll look into that. But anyway, so I thought that was kind of fun and interesting. The other thing that Kevin learned is that when you're switching camera gear, it's really helpful to work with others who already have it. So this was Kevin's first serious shoot with Olympus gear. So he had an EM1 Mark II, and he had some very nice glass to go with it. And by hanging out with other Olympus shooters on this workshop, he was able to get up to speed much faster with his camera than he would have been on his own. And I was thinking when he was talking about this that I think this is just an interesting thing with workshops in general, right? Is that, you know, you hang out with other people and you learn from them, whether it's about camera gear or technique or whatever. So I thought that was pretty fun. When I turned to Susie, she said, never do a workshop with only 7 men. But the thing that she really learned was the photographer's ephemeris, that app that Jeremy was using to help predict all the different events in the night sky, including the position of the galaxy, the Milky Way, moon, stars, sun, all that kind of stuff. Cool little app. And she downloaded it and was having fun with it right away. So that was something really important to her to help her get better at her star photography. And then she also learned about pano merging in Lightroom and that you come out with a DNG that you can still continue to play with and keep the quality up. That was new to her, and she had a lot of fun with that. Jeremy learned that he was over-dependent on technology because we had limited Wi-Fi, we had limited cell service, and he really felt the sting of that. He also really noticed that everyone sees things differently and that he missed shots that others got that were standing right next to him. And, you know, that's another fun thing that I like about our workshops is that, you know, when we do the presentation and you see a shot and you go, wow, that's fantastic. When did you take that? And the guy goes, when I was standing right next to you. And you go, ah. So, and he also really appreciated how people interpreted scenes differently, and he thought that brought a lot of interest and variety to the presentation. Fred experienced a graduated neutral density filter for the first time and was having a lot of fun with it on the workshop. He was thinking, okay, I want to learn this, and the workshop's a perfect place to do it. So he got one, he brought it along, and not only was he controlling the light top down as we think about these things, you know, for the bright sky, but we're in situations where maybe the light was coming in really hot on one side or the other. And he was using it for all those shots and really had a great time with it. And he also had a brand new enhancing filter that he was playing with, and he loved that as well. So Fred was really into new filters on this workshop. Workshops are perfect for those sort of things. Earl learned that for Milky Way shots, that there are some post-processing techniques that you can do where, for instance, you duplicate the layer of your star shot maybe 3 times and then use a blend mode, such as soft light, and that, you know, you can brighten the intensity of the stars and the color of the image. Now, of course, there's some tweaking that you have to do in addition to that. But so they started playing around with that. But that was really interesting to him, a software way to, you know, bring out more information in his star shots and get him to that point so that, you know, his shot looked the way that he saw it in his mind. He could actually get it that way on the computer screen. And the thing that Kirk learned or had fun learning was watching how we all packed our bags. Because he's really, you know, on the road to becoming even more nimble with his photography. And he was marveling at the way that, you know, we all packed our bags. And, you know, everyone has their way of doing it that has been a refined process that has evolved over countless shoots. And Kirk was just soaking that all up. And I think he's going to go back, maybe make a few equipment tweaks, maybe get a new bag and, you know, lighten up his load so that he can continue to travel light while he's taking pictures. Plus, he had to add on that he really enjoyed hanging around Susie and the guys. He just thought that, you know, the shared experience that we all enjoyed while working together in this beautiful setting, doing the thing that we love. He says, you know, it really doesn't get better than this when it comes to photography. And I'm going to close on that because I absolutely agree. Thank you, all of you, all the guys and Susie. I used to say, okay, guys and gal, it's time to go to our next shoot. And I hope I get to work with all of you again. I had a great time. Thank you so much. Do you have a film camera that needs a good home? So I haven't talked about this for a bit. We've been working on some other things, but I just want to mention that the film camera shop is my way to take cameras that aren't being used, to spruce them up, and then to get them into hands of people who want to shoot with film cameras. The film camera shop, all one word, is on Etsy. And you know, that's where I distribute these. I sell these. It's just really terrific. And your donations of film cameras, if you have some that you're not using and you want to get them into good hands, what it allows me to do then is spend more time working on them. It allows me to film test them. It allows me to take, you know, all the preparation of that camera to a new level that you just don't see usually when you buy film cameras on eBay and so forth, where they're just trying to, you know, move them along and make a little money on them. If you want to participate, use the contact form on the nimblephotographer.com. Let me know what you have and, you know, we'll set it up. But your donations of film cameras, you know, help our virtual camera club, you know, in similar ways that the other ways that people contribute. I really appreciate it. And like I said, if you got a great camera that's not being used, let's get it in the hands of someone who will. And finally, just a few updates. Our Inner Circle members, we have a great activity this month. We're doing photo critique, and I've already received some candidates, and every week I'm going to pick one of those candidates. I'm going to write a photo critique on it, and then all of you can chime in as well. And then the lucky photographer will get, you know, the kind of feedback that we all crave. You know, this is what we did up in the mountains for our photography workshop, where you get feedback from people who really care about photography. So make sure that you follow our activity on the Patreon site where all the Inner Circle stuff happens. I'm going to get the first one up later this week, and I think this is going to be a great activity for October. If you're interested in supporting the Digital Story and becoming an Inner Circle member where you can participate in these sort of things and feel good about supporting this podcast, just click on the tile that appears on all the pages of the Digital Story, and it'll take you over to our Patreon site. You can see what's going on, and maybe you'll join the Inner Circle. I would love it if you did. Big thanks to all of our Inner Circle members right now. I so appreciate your contribution. And finally, be sure to visit our friends at Red River Paper. They have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. They supply paper, inkjet supplies, tutorials, reviews, anything that's paper that comes out of an inkjet printer. They probably have their fingers on it. And it's fun. I took some Polar Luster metallic prints up to the workshop by request and let people play with them. And they are so beautiful. But that's just one of the surfaces that Red River Paper carries. They have tons more fine art cards in various sizes, envelopes, glassine sleeves, big sheets of paper, rolls of paper, you name it, they have it. Click on the tile, go see what's going on, and make some art that people can hold and appreciate. Big thanks to Red River Paper, and make sure you visit their Facebook page at facebook.com redriverpaper. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. And I'm working on some stories for next week and beyond. Please come back and join me next Tuesday. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.